Okay. So, last time we talked about device files, so the interface we have on a POSIX-like system to external devices, well, looks like a file. We mentioned this earlier in the semester. And we started looking at sort of what happens under the hood. And so with a device file, we have sort of this read and write call, same interface as before, but rather than, you know, doing what it would do for a regular file or going through the page cache, it would typically go through the device driver, which would have, you know, whatever semantics made sense for the type of device. We do one thing for a keyboard, one thing for an audio output, and so on. We also mentioned that, well, we also need to deal with devices when we have something like a disk that we want to use with the page cache. And typically what Unix-like systems do there is they have sort of a slightly different interface for what they call block devices that work with the page cache. You can access them directly through a device file, but most commonly they're accessed via the page cache. So their device drivers implement this sort of read and write page operation that the page cache wants. We talked about, well, if we know about this interface, how does that work with the code that actually communicates with the device? And we divided that code into two halves. What we called the top half was the half that sort of was triggered from the system call. And typically, there would be a kernel buffer. So this is a kernel buffer, and the system call implementation would read or write that buffer and would put the current process to sleep until enough data was ready in that buffer, or in the case of writing, until like there was space in the buffer. The bottom half would be the half actually responsible for communicating with the device, and when we had to wait for the device to tell us it's ready to receive or for us to send data, you know, this would be triggered from the trap handler. And this code would be responsible for copying to and from the device and would also trigger a wake up for programs that were waiting for the buffer to have more stuff that's ready for them to use. And some people observe that this looks very much like our sort of producer-consumer pattern. Depending on whether we're reading or writing, the top half is a producer or consumer, and the bottom half is a consumer or producer. Now, we talked about like copying to the device and telling the device to do things. How did that actually work from the perspective of the processor? And what we learned is that we put the devices on the memory bus. So the same way we communicated with memory, we needed to handle having multiple processors communicating with the same memory. So we already have this sort of hardware mechanism where we can send messages between different pieces of hardware, and we just reuse that to communicate with the devices. And well, we wouldn't communicate with like the keyboard directly, but we communicate with what we called a device controller, sort of something that sort of, in the case of a keyboard, would understand the raw signals from key presses and translate them to something that made sense on that memory bus interface. And what these device controllers could do is they could expose what looks to the processor like memory locations, but because they're handling the reads and writes to them, they can make them do whatever, you know, makes sense for the device controller. So in the case of a keyboard controller, it could be the case that when you read the memory location for the current key press, it gives you the key press that just happened and also, you know, clears the state of that key press so the device controller knows to not, you know, signal you until next time you want a key press or next time there is a key press. Now, when we were looking at this idea of these magic memory locations, it looked like the way we were going to send data to a device, like say a network controller, was by having these write instructions run in ROS that would write to one of these magic memory locations, and the device controller would, you know, get that data and send it out in case of a network controller, on the network. But for large data transfers, like with networks and disks, this is often, you know, pretty inefficient. So we want to do something else, and the most common idea is this thing called direct memory access, or DMA, where we say, oh, the device controller's already on the memory bus, and the memory bus is how you read and write things from memory. So why don't we have the device controller, you know, do what the processor could do itself and read and write from memory? And the OS can take advantage of this by, instead of copying data from this kernel buffer here to the device, it can just tell the device, hey, I already have the data you want in this kernel buffer, or hey, you know, I'm going to expect you to write the data to this buffer here. Just do it for me, you know, talk to the memory, and don't bug me until you're done with it. And this means that a large transfer can happen while the OS or the processor is doing other things, and this makes this much more efficient, and it's what you definitely want to be happening for things like disks and network, where we're moving lots of data. For things like a keyboard, it doesn't really make sense because, you know, yeah, the keyboard controller could write the key press directly to the OS's buffer, but we'd still want to, like, wake up the OS and tell it to handle it, and it would still need to check some device controller registers to see what happened. And so with a key press, since that's so little data, we really wouldn't be saving any time. So questions about these topics we covered last time? I see we have a logistics question, so I'll have some logistics issues I should talk about. So one logistics issue is that there's no class on Thursday, because that's a break day, assuming I read the schedule correctly, which I certainly hope I did. And related to that, the post quiz for this week, will be released by tomorrow morning. Because it should be released before Thursday. So, and a question on the pool assignment. Yes, I would have liked to have that graded, but I did not coordinate correctly with my TAs in figuring out how fast they would get grading done, or at least, so we're a little behind on that. Pool, more than other assignments, requires a lot of manual grading, because we can, like, detect race conditions, but we need to look at them because often students will have code with race conditions that we don't want to take off credit for. But obviously that takes a bit of time to figure out. And a question, do we need to know anything about the memory bus itself? I'm deliberately taking sort of an extremely high-level view of how the memory bus works. It's possible that it's covered in DLD. I would suspect it's more likely to be covered in some CPE course. And the question, will the quiz be due the same time as usual? Yes. The quiz will still be due before lecture next Tuesday. Other questions? Okay, can I go over, people asking if I can go over the last quiz questions 5 and 6. Okay, so let's do that. So question 5 is asking, okay, so let's say we're reading from a keyboard using this read command, and we're telling you that the way that the keyboard device driver works is that it copies into a kernel managed buffer from the interrupt handler. And the process wants to retrieve this data. And we're saying that this already happened here. So the data is already available. So that means that we should just copy it right away. These other cases kind of, you know, only make sense if we couldn't already have the data in the kernel managed buffer. But since the data is already in the kernel managed buffer, we want to return that data. We better not return some other data. And if you're thinking about a keyboard, it wouldn't make very much sense for me to press some keys and then you try to read them and you get later keys. Like, that's not how we usually expect sort of a keyboard input to work. And we're also saying it's retrieving this data. And for question six, we're saying that we're using direct memory access. So if we're using direct memory access, that means the device controller is going to do the actual data transfer. But in order to do that, the OS just needs to tell the device controller, hey, here's where you want to write or read or write, and you know, how much data there is. And obviously, you know, the device controller isn't going to know how much data there is until the OS decides to send that data. But the process of deciding to send that data is going to be telling it, here's the data, here's how much it is, start copying it. And that's what setting a control register would do. So I guess the most popular wrong option is this by the device controller after the OS triggers an interrupt. So if the OS wants to do something with the device controller, it can just do it without any sort of exception happening. And interrupts are signals from the device to the OS in the context of I/O or from an application to the OS. There's no reason it would make sense for the OS to signal itself, which is what we kind of be saying would be happening here. Other questions, follow-ups? Okay, so let's move on to our main topic for today, which is going to, as I finish, question four, now that I mysteriously closed my quiz window, okay, so question four. Is asking about simulating this access pattern. And so what happens here is that we access E, and that's going to use the page 4 to store E, which previously stored D. And then it's going to be at the top of the active list. So the top of the active list is going to be page 4, then 1, and this 2 will go to the top of the inactive list, and 3 will be at the bottom of the inactive list. Then we access A, which is still on the active list, so nothing needs to happen. And then we access C, which is on the inactive list, so it's going to be immediately moved to from the bottom of the inactive list to the top of the active list because of the rule that whenever a page isn't is accessed on the inactive list, is moved to the top of the active list. And that pushes A, page 1, to the top of the inactive list, and page 4 to the bottom of the active list. So that explain things. I can probably go through this Yeah. In more detail on Piazza if that's not good enough. It's probably the right place to do it. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So our main topic for today is going to be about the FAT file system. And we mentioned when finishing up last time that it's named after the file allocation table, which is sort of its main data structure. Now, to talk about how FAT works, we first need to talk about how we split up a disk, which is going to be a hard drive or a solid state disk. And I mentioned when talking about the interface to the device itself that we have sectors, and sectors are the unit the device controller understands. When we want to read from or write to a solid state disk or a hard drive from the OS, we specify a set of sectors to read or write. And sectors are, you know, historically were half a kilobyte. These days they're often bigger because it turns out half a kilobyte doesn't make much sense when your disk is a terabyte or more. And FAT divides the disk into what we'll call clusters. And clusters are going to be composed of one or more sectors. And so basically what FAT is saying here is that, yeah, there's a certain size the hardware has divided the disk into, but that might not be what's convenient for me as the OS, you know, organizing the data on the disk. So we're going to have this possibly larger unit we're going to divide the disk into called a cluster. And when we want to read or write a cluster, we're just going to tell the disk to write the corresponding sector or sectors. So a question, do SSDs use the same setup? So SSDs provide the same interface, even though the underlying hardware works very differently. And you can think of SSDs as kind of, you know, making something that's, looks very different from a hard drive look like a hard drive. Another question, are the clusters adjacent on disk? So generally, sectors that have similar sector numbers will be physically close to each other on a hard drive. On a solid state disk, this might not be true, but on a solid state disk, if things are far apart, that doesn't really make it slower to access them because we don't have to physically move ahead. And our clusters are going to be composed of consecutively numbered sectors, sort of. So our clusters, you know, are just consecutively numbered sectors. So if this is cluster 24, this will presumably be sector, you know, 24 times 4, and so on. Or plus 1, etc. Now, since we're dividing up the disk into these clusters, we're going to use this when we're storing a file. So, in fact, the data for a file is going to be stored in a list of clusters. So there's somewhere they're going to store a list of cluster numbers, and that's where the file's data is going to be. It's okay for a file to not be in contiguous clusters, though for a hard drive where we have to physically move ahead, it would be faster if it was in contiguously numbered clusters. So when we want to read, say, this example.txt file, we need to get this list of cluster number 10, 13, 14, and 15, and then use that to actually read the appropriate sectors from the disk. Now you might say, does this mean, you know, if we have, say, 2 kilobyte clusters, that all our files are going to be 2, 4, 6, 8 kilobytes? Well, they're going to take up that much space, but we're going to support other file sizes by just saying, you know, if you don't use all the space, we're just going to waste some space. So it might be the case that, you know, example.txt is only 3.5 clusters in size, in which case the last half of one of the clusters will just not have any useful data in it. So you might say, where do we store this list of clusters? And the FAT approach is that it's stored in the file allocation table, which basically keeps a linked list. So the file allocation table is an array, and the entries in the array are basically next pointers for a linked list. And they contain a number indicating the next cluster. So, for example, if we have a file that starts in cluster 10 and then has 14, 15, and 13, if this is the, you know, clusters of example.txt, and it's in this order, then we might store in entry 10 of the FAT, 14, to say after 14, so after 10 is 14, and in entry 14 of the FAT, we'll store 15 to say after 14 is 15, and in entry 15 of the FAT, we'll store 13 to say after 15 is 13, and in entry 13, we'll store a special value. In this case, I've indicated negative 1, you know, sort of special end marker, you know, not, which is, you know, maybe negative 1, or another similar value. So some special value that indicates that we're at the end of a list that corresponds to like a null in a linked list. So basically we have a linked list. We're just storing it in this array because we don't like have pointers and we don't want to store other things in the actual clusters where the file data is. So if we have this array, you might say, where is this array stored? And the FAT solution is that they're going to store this array in some of the early clusters on the disk. So these clusters where this array is stored, we're not going to put any files there. We're just going to store this data as just a big array. And, you know, this array will tell us about all the files. So we can see here that cluster 7, 8, and 9 store one contiguous file. So index 7 points to 8, index 8 points to 9, index 9 indicates end of file. And we have our example from before of a file that starts at 10, goes to 14, then 15, then 13, and so on. So a question, does this still work with varying size sectors in each cluster? So when I said the sector size could vary, I meant that different disks could choose different sector sizes. The sector size for a particular disk is going to be fixed. Question, if you had an entry value point to itself, that would lead to an endless file. So yes, with this scheme, we would probably consider that malformed. And the question is, the index into this file allocation table is the cluster number we're trying to access? Yes. And when I'm writing the index here, you know, this is not actually stored on the disk. This is just going to tell us how far into this array that's stored here we need to go. Other questions? Question, how do we know where a file begins? We're going to get that, but it turns out it's going to be stored in other files, and there's going to be a first file. And another question, is there a way to mark an unused spot? Yes. So now that we know sort of the layout of this file allocation table, let's think about how we read a file. So if we know its start location, we can, you know, is say X, we read the starting cluster, then we go up to the FAT to read the entry with index X to get the next cluster number, and we just repeat this until we see the end marker. So translating a linked list. So the question is then, how do we get these start locations? So for start locations, well, you know, one option would be that we could have users, like, instead of saying example.txt, say, I want file that starts at cluster 10. That's a real option, but not really what we want. We really want file names. And they're going to be stored in what we'll call directories. And you might say, well, what is a directory in this FAT thing? And in FAT, and this is actually a very common pattern among all sorts of file systems, a directory is a file, but rather than storing bytes that an application would use, its data, you know, is just a list of other files. So it's a file, it has data just like a normal file does, but rather than its data just being arbitrary bytes, its data is a list of sort of the names and starting locations and some other data about files. So the question, does it use up a lot of space to use up the cluster at the end of a file with an end mark? So I guess one thing I should make clear is that if we had a file which only, say, used cluster 26, then we'd store that, with a just an end mark. So it's true that we would need a full cluster for this, no matter how big the file was, but we don't need an extra cluster for a file that only takes up one cluster, that has less than one cluster of data. Does that clarify things? Okay. So now let's look at directories. So a directory is going to be a list of what we'll call directory entries. And a directory entry will say, oh, there's a file named something. It starts at this cluster, and in fact, we'll say, oh, and it's this big. And also some other data. And it's going to be an array of these for whatever the size of the directory is. So if our directory is stored in these two clusters, when we look at these two clusters, we'll get all these entries. It's an array of these entries, but some of the array entries might be marked as unused. Why would we do this? This is how we can conveniently delete a directory entry, like delete a file, without needing to move everything else in the directory. And if we're like being asked, say, to open index.html, what we're going to do is we're going to scan these directory entries until we find index.html. And once we do, we're going to say, okay, well, it starts at cluster 10, and we're going to follow the chain in the FAT for cluster 10. Let's say in this case it goes 10 to 11, then 11 to 15 to 16, and you know the first part of the file is going to come from the first cluster, the second part from the second, and so on. And we'll know how much to use through the size we got in the directory entry. So in this case, we know that even though we have four full clusters of 4K, which is 16K, we know it's not actually 16 kilobytes, because the directory entry said so. And we'll know to just ignore the bottom part of this cluster. Okay. So questions about this? So does this mean having a lot of small files will lead to a lot of unused space? Yes. So we're going to see that something that generally happens in these file systems is that there's this kind of compromise between sort of the size of our cluster and sort of how much bookkeeping we do if we have a very small size, or how much space we waste for small files if we have a large size. Okay. So far I've shown you these very abstracted directory entries, but we're going to actually have you write a program for the next set of assignments that reads from a FAT file system. We're not going to have you like get a physical disk, but we're going to give you a single file that is the contents of a disk and ask you to read out directories in it. So given that, we should talk about sort of the actual format of FAT directory entries. And FAT is kind of historical, but it's probably the simplest file system, which is why our assignment uses it. Because we wanted a really simple file system that's real. And part of it being historical is that it stores the name and extension in this sort of fixed length field, which you may notice has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 characters for the name and 3 characters for the extension. This was designed when they didn't think about having larger. Now, FAT has since had support for larger file names. We're not going to have you implement that. So our directory entry here, it says this file is named readme.txt. You may notice that FAT has this convention about how it stores, you know, the name here is that it pads it with spaces and puts the extension in the last 3 bytes of this field. That's sort of what they've decided. And it starts in a particular cluster, and they've stored the cluster in 2 parts, which are not together. You might say, why did they do that? Well, because it used to be the case that there was only this part. And then they realized, wait a moment, disks are bigger than that. So they added the second part. Yeah. And so we have this file name. So if there's longer file names, the encoding is that they're encoded using extra directory entries. We're not going to go into detail about how that works, but I'll mention that those extra directory names have this attributes field set differently so you can know to distinguish them from normal directory entries. Now, this attribute field is also used for some other interesting things. So this is how we can tell whether a file is a directory, a subdirectory, or a normal file. Is that we'll set this value differently. It's also used for other information like read-only and hidden. So a question, do we need to worry about the format of the linked list in FAT? Yes, because you'll need to read files, and to figure out where all the data for the file is, you need the linked list. Now, for these directory entries, we don't actually, you know, have a linked list here. We just get the beginning of a file. Now, there's some things I showed you earlier that's not apparent here. So one thing is I mentioned that we could have unused directory entries. So like if we deleted a file, typically we just overwrite that directory entry and not move the other ones around. And what FAT has chosen to do is to use this first character of the file name and have some special first characters. So one is that a null first character is what they use to indicate we're done with this directory and there's no more directory entries. So if you think of, like, if we have 4 kilobyte clusters and we have only, you know, 2 directory entries, then, you know, most of that space is unused and we'd like not to scan it. So we'll have that 0 to say after the first 2 entries to say there's nothing more. And holes, like if from file deletion, are represented with character E5. And that means that, you know, it's not the last entry, but it, you know, there's entries afterwards, but this entry is not meaningful. You shouldn't use it. And conveniently, because this is the sort of direct file name field, like even if you didn't implement that logic, you probably wouldn't accidentally open this file. Now, I've shown you sort of how these directory entries are packed, and this ends up being 32 bytes. And it might seem like, gosh, the code to access this seems real tedious because I'm like going to need to do a bunch of bit shifting and, you know, or, you know, in order to like construct this file size together from the bytes and all that sort of thing. But most commonly, we're going to try to have our compiler help us a little bit with this. So when we're accessing these directory entries from C, what you'll typically see done, including in sort of in the OS implementation of file systems, is we'll make a struct that we carefully write to have the same layout in memory as on the disk. So when we read from the disk, we can just copy into this struct or even cast something as this struct, and it will be exactly have things in exactly the same place. And to do this, I've done some things that are maybe a little exotic. So one thing you might notice is that I'm using these types uint8t and uint16t and uint32t, where I know what size they are. So I'm not using int or long, because I want to say, you know, no matter what architecture I'm running on, this better be 16 bits. I'm also using this marker here to say packed. And what this is telling the compiler is, hey, I know you might want to add some padding in order to improve performance. Don't do that, because I really need this to be laid out exactly like this. I don't care if things are not aligned to multiples of two, and that would be a lot faster. And I guess something I'd note is that we are going to take advantage of one thing that we might have to deal with in other architectures, which is that everything is little endian. So it's little endian on disk because FAT was designed for x86. If we were using a big endian system, we would need to do something about that. And so I'm going to supply you with this struct. And since I'm doing that, you might wonder, I mean, gosh, why did you choose these horrible names? And I chose these horrible names because Microsoft has some documentation about the FAT file system. And I chose these names to match the documentation. And I think overall that's sort of a win, because you want to read that to do the assignment, so it's easier to figure out, you know, if you're actually accessing the field specified in that documentation. Okay. So since we know how that the directories are a list of files, you know, talk about, well, how do we use that? So often we're going to have a path that involves multiple directories. So what's the process for this? Well, we're going to read a root directory. So this is sort of the first directory. We'll talk about that in a second. And we're going to read its directory entries, and we're going to search for one called foo. Then once we find foo, we're going to read foo's directory entries and search for one called bar. And then we're going to read bar's directory entries and search for one called baz. And we're going to read baz's directory entries and search for one called file.txt. And then finally, when we find file.txt, we'll get its data and be able to actually read, you know, or write that file. And something you might notice about this process is that, you know, this seems is straightforward, like we're doing the same thing over and over again. It's a loop or something recursive. But in an OS, we wouldn't want to do this every time we open a file. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, sort of page caches came into being, is that we'd really like these reads to all not actually go to disk and to be served from our cached version. But for the assignment, we're not going to worry about that. You're just going to, you know, access the file normally. Now, we have to deal with this root directory question. So where is the root directory? And well, we need to know where it is. So there's going to be some cluster number that contains the root directory. And what cluster number is that? And you might say, okay, we could like put it in cluster number one, but we kind of have a problem with that idea, which is that, well, I'm putting other stuff around here. So there might be other things there, like the FAT. So where do we put it? Well, there's going to be one other data structure I didn't talk about, which we'll call the file system header. So this is going to be at a fixed location, basically at the beginning of the disk. We're going to have this header, and it's going to contain all sorts of information about how we need to interpret the rest of the disk. So, for example, I mentioned clusters are some number of sectors. Well, how many? Well, we find that out by reading this header. And so that's how we deal with that, you know, choice being different between different disks, is that, well, when we find the disk we want to read, you know, we can figure out what the choice is for that disk. And also, we write down, you know, what our sector size that we're assuming is. We have this notion of reserve sector. So one thing we need to figure out is where the FAT is. I just kind of said it's near the beginning of the disk, but its location actually is kind of variable. And the solution FAT has for that is in the header, we have this reserve sector count, and that tells us where the FAT starts in a number of sectors. So here it's 5, which means it starts in the middle of the of cluster 1. And we also need to know how big the FAT is. So we have this field called FAT size, which is in clusters. So in this case, it's 11, sorry, in sectors. So in this case, it's 11 sectors long. And another one of these fields, what we were finally looking for, is this root directory cluster. And so that's going to tell us where the root directory is. And when we're making and setting up a new disk, we can choose a different location for this depending on how big our file allocation table is. So questions about this header and the root directory location? So a question, why is the number of FATs 2? Yeah, so there's a feature called a backup FAT. So basically, the file allocation table, it's really important. If this gets damaged, then, you know, it's going to be really hard to recover the data off this disk. So to deal with that, the designers of FAT decided that they're going to have 2 copies of the FAT on the disk, where the idea is that if this part of the disk or the SSD gets damaged, hopefully the backup copy will be okay and they'll still be able to read the files. And the number of FATs field in the header says how many backup copies there are. Other questions? Question, how many backup copies is typical? 2. But it's configurable. Or sorry, 1 copy is, 1 backup is typical, 2 copies total is typical. But it's configurable. So that's the file system header. And like the directory entry, we're going to provide you with a carefully written struct that, you know, has this exact same layout as the file system header. So we have our bytes per sector, sectors per cluster fields, we have our reserve sector count, and we have our number of FATs, and also there's some information you can look up in Microsoft's documentation about telling you which ones are in use. Okay, so we've told you about reading files from the FAT file system. Next, we're going to get into writing. So first, a question, why did they put the backup FAT next to the original? Isn't that bad if we're thinking about the disk getting damaged because they're close by on a hard drive? And yes, it is. It is not the choice that other file systems have made for similar things. So, for example, the sort of extended 2 file system tries to spread out its equivalent backup copies. Other questions before we talk about writing files? Okay. So, talked about reading files. Let's say we want to write a file. Well, there's going to be a bunch of parts. So one part is we need to add a directory entry. So most commonly, we're going to have a directory, and it's not going to use all of the space in its array of directory entries, and we just fill in an unused entry, like at the end, for example. If in the uncommon case, maybe it used up all the space allocated and we allocate a new cluster for the directory and place the entry there. After that, we have to like choose places to put the data for the file and then update the FAT to reflect that. And you might say, well, how do we choose where to put a file? We have to know what clusters are free. So what data structure are we going to use for that? And the answer is we're going to use the FAT. That, well, the FAT entries for unused clusters are going to be, you know, have something in them. So the choice we'll make is we'll put some marker that indicates they're free, and typically we'll use a zero. So all the clusters that don't have data in them will, in the file allocation table, be marked with zero. And when we want to allocate a file, we're going to scan this file allocation table and choose in any way we like some places to put our file, and then we're going to update those entries to point to link up the file. So in this case, I wanted to allocate a file in clusters 21, 22, 24. So I made 21.2, 22, and 22.2, 24. And I made 24 point to the end of file marker to indicate that's the end. So question, how can you add a directory entry before choosing the clusters? You can't add a correct directory entry before choosing the clusters, yes. That is a sort of an omission on this slide. Here. Other questions? Okay, so once we've chosen a place for the file, we're going to hopefully just edit an unused directory entry to point to that cluster. But in some unlucky cases, we're going to need to expand the directory. So in that case, what we'll do is we'll say, okay, I already have this directory here, but it didn't have enough space. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to find an empty cluster, just like I did for the file, and allocate a new one and place at the beginning of that my new directory entry. Other questions? Okay. So now that we've gone through facts. So I have these. Question is, so we copy over and make a new one. So in this case, here, where we're allocating a new cluster for the directory, we aren't copying the original. We're linking up a new one to append to the directory because there's no space in here with an unused entry. Whereas in the other case, there was an unused entry we could have replaced. The question, does this mean we have to scan the directory to see if all entries are taken? Yes. And this, you might observe, is the way in which FAT is maybe not super efficient. Let's do this exercise. So I'm asking, I have A, B, C dot text, and I'm asking, we have these three operations. Which of these six things are modified or might be modified for these operations? And ignore timestamp updates. So if you look carefully at directory entries, they had times in them. Let's ignore changing those, even though that is, yeah, a lot of stuff will have to change. So. So I'll give another 20 seconds or so. Okay, so for one, we have consensus that we need to modify the data for c.txt. So assuming we're creating it as a non-empty file, we would need to do that. If it was empty, we wouldn't. Fat entries for it. Yeah, we need to do that. Assuming it's not going to be empty, we need to set those up. And we also might need to make a directory entry. So we need to modify the data clusters for B, which is where the directory entry is stored. And we may need to modify, this should be E. And we might need to modify the direct fat entries for B, if we need a new more space for the directory entry. If there's not enough space in the existing clusters for directory B. So key thing is that this is where directory entries are stored for B are stored. In these data clusters. For truncating it, we're going to need to modify its directory entry, so that's E. And we should also modify its fat entries, which is C, in order to mark it as deleted. We don't need to modify, so we could clear off the we could clear out the data clusters, but we don't need to do that. We just need to mark them as unused. And we probably won't change them. We're just going to mark them as free. And for three, we have... we're definitely going to need to modify D and E because we need to overwrite a directory entry that's in B and put it in A. And we might also need to modify A in order to free up space to add more space for directory entries. We don't actually need to modify F, and there's no reason to modify F because the file's contents doesn't change, its location on disk doesn't need to change, and the same is true with C. Because we don't need to change where the file is or that linked list, we just need to change the directory entry that points to the beginning of it. So the question is, are directory tables ever shrinked when a bunch of files are deleted? The file system format doesn't specify whether that happens, but that is something an implementation could do. Other questions? And we mentioned that for freeing up space, freeing up space by truncating a file, we set the fat entries to free. If we're deleting a file, we just overwrite a directory entry with unused. Maybe we'll rewrite it later to save space. But it's not actually necessary, but obviously would be nice to do. Okay, so another exercise on fats. So let's say I have a directory. So we need directory entries of 230 kilobyte files. And we need the file data. I'm asking how many clusters sort of outside of the fat and how many fat entries. And those are going to be the same thing, right? Because we need to have a fat entry for every cluster we use. And the same question for a directory of 2,000 3K files. So first thing I would think about is how big the directory entries are. So we have 32 times 200. Which is going to be 40 bytes, which is, and you should think about how big this is. And if we think about these clusters, this is going to be, which is 3 1/8 of a cluster of just directory entries. So the other thing I think about is, let's think about one of these 30 kilobyte files. So we've counted for the directory entry. So we have 30 kilobytes and we have 2 kilobyte clusters. So we need 15 clusters for this data. So times 200 files, that gives us 3,000 clusters of just the data. So I was hoping more people would make me far along. So I guess while you're thinking about the second one, I will go through explaining the first question here. So have part of the answer. So we need to store the clusters and the corresponding fat entries for these directory entries. And I told you these take up 3 1/8 clusters. Now, we can't actually store an eighth of a cluster because we have to allocate a whole cluster at a time to a file or directory. So we're going to end up storing 4 clusters and fat entries to handle the directory itself. And for the file data, well, we're going to have, by this calculation, 3,000 clusters and corresponding fat entries. So that gives us 3,004. And for second part here, we can figure out the directory part in a similar way. We can say we have 2,000 times 32, which is 64,000 bytes, which ends up being, if we, I'm going to get the exact number, but you could, so, yeah, which is going to be 31 and 1/4 of a cluster, but we can't store a quarter of, allocate a quarter of a cluster's directory, only a whole cluster, so this is going to be, this directory is going to be 32 clusters. And then the question is how big these files are. I guess I'm going to stop here, start giving away the answer. And sort of the plurality of people on the quiz have figured out, well, you'd think, okay, you might say, well, we have 2,000 files times 3 kilobytes. That's 6,000 kilobytes divided by 2 kilobytes a cluster. And you might say that's 3,000, but this doesn't work. And the reason why is that to store a 3-kilobyte file, we're going to store it in, we're going to use, this is going to be two clusters, two clusters, even though where we're going to have 3 kilobytes of data and 1 kilobyte unused. And that's because we can't share a cluster between two different files. So we're going to waste, a lot of space because these files are, not a nice even multiple of the cluster size. So we end up having each of the 2,000 files takes up two clusters, so we have 4,000 clusters. So we end up with 4,032 clusters. Questions on how I figured that out? I would anticipate some because I had so few quiz responses to the poll. Guess not. Things people are confused by. Question. So to adjust for this, we adjust to make sure the x3 is a multiple of x2. What I would say is we're adjusting to, is what I would say this process is that I looked at this 3 kilobytes and I first say how many clusters per file, make that a whole number, and then use that. So remember, we always need a whole number of clusters for each file. That answer that question? Okay. So that's everything we're going to talk about the FAT file system. And XV6 doesn't use this file system and uses a design that's a little bit different. So we're going to talk about that. And the XV6 design we're going to talk about because it's very similar to most modern Unix file systems. And it does some things better than FAT. So there's some differences are just naming things. So when we're talking about the XV6 file system or file system of Linux, they're going to call what FAT calls clusters blocks. It's just a difference in name, but that's the name they're going to use. Some other things are going to be named differently. And we're going to show what the the layout looks like. And unlike the FAT, we're going to have sort of the information that's stored in the FAT and directory entry split across the file system in a different way. So here's the layout of the XV6 disk. So we have the boot block, and we have what's called the super block, which is the equivalent of FAT's header. So they call it the super block. FAT would call it a header, but it's the same idea. And this tells us where the other parts of the file system are. In this case, we're not saying where the FAT is or where the root directory is. That's going to be done a different way, but it's telling us how the disk is laid out, how big blocks are is fixed, but it tells us that information. And probably the biggest difference between the sort of FAT file system, and this is where information about files is stored. So in the FAT file system, we stored information about files in the directory entries. Here, we're going to have a separate array for information about files called the inode array, which is going to store inodes, which are going to be our information about files, except for their name. So the file names are going to be in the directory entry, but everything else about a file is going to be in this inode array. And this includes where the file's data is. So we have the file type, which was that attributes field in FAT. We have information if it's a device file that tells us what device it refers to. We have its size, which in FAT, remember that was in the directory entry. Here we're storing it in a different location. And we have this pointer to the actual data of the file. And rather than having a linked list, we have an array of the locations of each block of the file. So if the file is in 11:14, adders of 0 will be 11, adders of 1 will be 14. There's not going to be a linked list to follow. So since we're keeping track of where the file's data is sort of in this data, that structure where we have inodes per file, you might say, how do we figure out what blocks are free? And the solution we're going to use for that is we're going to have a separate data structure that tracks which blocks are in use. Because otherwise we have to scan all the files to see, does anyone use block 11? Instead, we're going to have just an array of bits telling us, is block X used? Now, that tells us about allocating blocks. What about allocating inodes? The XV6 solution is that this type field has a sort of zero value for unused, and we scan for an unused one. Many other Unix-like file systems will have similar to this bit array of is it used for blocks, we'll have that for inodes. So something you might say is, wait a moment, this inode array is fixed in size. What if I have more files than that? And the answer is, too bad. You have to reformat your disk. So questions about this overall structure? Question, what do we mean by reformat the disk? You're going to have to resize this inode array. You have to move move everything after it on the disk, which basically is going to be a big process. Involve a big process. Does that answer that question? Okay, so talked about how inodes work, and I mentioned that we still had directory entries. They just have a lot less information because most of the information about a file is in this inode. So what do the directory entries look like? In XV6, this is a directory entry. It has an inode number, so an index into this array of inodes here, and a name. That's it. So unlike our FAT entries, we aren't storing any other information there. Just this pointer to an array entry. And each of these directory references on Unix-like systems is called a hard link, and you can actually have two different directories point to the same file. That's a supported feature, which is what this endlink field is for, to tell how many pointers there are to this file. So the question is, given that our directory entries are so small, aren't we wasting a lot of space with directories because they take up a whole block? And the answer is probably. Okay. So talk about where things are stored. Okay, so another complaint you might have had about this versus FAT is you might say, well, FAT, we had this linked list, that's kind of awkward to traverse, but at least it supports arbitrary large files. Here it seems like you're telling me that if this ndirect value isn't big enough, then you know, too bad you can't make a file that big. And, well, XV6 isn't quite as bad as that. So, XV6, that adders array, well, I told you that, you know, if our file data was in block 10, then 14, you know, we'd have adder 0 would equal 10, and adder 1 would equal 14. But the last entry of this array is treated differently. If this is an indirect pointer, and what we do with that is that we say, you know, after we get to, you know, the 12th block of the file, that's just a number XV6 chose arbitrarily, we're going to store not a pointer to the next block here, we're going to store a pointer to more pointers. So we call this an indirect pointer, and we call these direct pointers. You know, direct, I should say, block pointer is an indirect block pointer. And this indirect block pointer points to a block which only holds an array of other block numbers. And that's where the data for the file is stored. And this gives us a lot more ability to store, you know, big files. That because, you know, so, we can just, you know, as long as we can store a whole block worth, and how big that is depends how big our blocks are. So, for example, you know, if, so let's say the block 12 was, of the file was stored at, is block number 25, and let's say our first entry in this end of block was 26, 27. This is sort of how we could, you know, we have 26 stored in here, 27, you know, let's say it's 30. You know, these pointers would tell us where the next part of the file data is. And the data for the file is just all of these put together. Questions about this indirect block idea? Question is, how do directory entries contain the list of files? So the directory entries are going to be, so a directory is going to be an array of these. So our directory is going to be, have a, like, so let's say our directory, we have foo.txt, which is file number 17, and bar.txt, which is file number 20. Our directory entry is going to be 17, foo.txt, 20, bar.txt. This is going to be what's in our directory, is these two directory entries. And the actual location of foo.txt will be in an inode at index 17, which will have these block pointers in that inode. Does that answer that question about how the directory entries contain the list of files? Question, does this mean no two files with the same name? So in a directory, we can't have two files with the same name, but like that, we can have nested directories, and we do that procedure of look at the root, look at, you know, look, if we're looking for foo/bar/baz, look for foo in the root, then look for bar and foo, and so on. So question, if I have a foo, an a/foo and an a/bar, would it just be next to each other in memory? So they'd be in the same, they probably have their directory entries stored close together in on the disk, but the actual file data could be spread widely apart for the foo and the bar files. They could have very different IDO numbers. So it might be the case that foo is stored here and bar is stored here, but there'd be a directory entries that would probably come from the same block giving those two numbers. Does that answer that question? Okay. So that's XV6, has that arrangement, and XV6 uses 512 byte blocks. And so this means that with one indirect block, we can store an extra 256 block pointers because they use 2-byte block pointers. So XV6's maximum file size is this number, which actually isn't that big. And you might say, how do we make this work, you know, on a real file system? You know, XV6 is kind of a toy, and this seems like too small to be practical. This is like less than a megabyte. And, well, Linux, in the sort of default Extended 2, Extended 3 file system, uses the same idea. So they have inodes. Their inodes have a few bits of extra information in them, like modification times, but they also have this array of block pointers. But they use more indirection. So rather than just having a pointer to pointers, they have a pointer to pointers to pointers, and a pointer to pointers to pointers. And this allows you to have extremely large files, which is why you've never gone to a Linux system and said, gosh, it doesn't support big enough files. Okay. So questions about this? I think this is where I'm out of time for today. So we'll pick up here next time. Question, is today's lecture all that will be on the next quiz? Yes.